Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spiritual Insights with Charlotte Spicer. Spirituality and Metaphysics Talk Radio, featuring A Course in Miracles, Dream Interpretation, Guided Meditation, and the Psychic and Metaphysics Free-for-All. It's your opportunity to consult with a professional psychic medium, discuss past lives, the chakras, and more. We are non-denominational, and there are no limits. Want to change your life? You must first change your mind. No matter your religious structure, cultivate peace in your reality through self-awareness with an authentic spiritual teacher. And now, your host, Charlotte Spicer.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is Charlotte Spicer. We have a wonderful show for you tonight. Our special guest is Miss Carol M. Howe. Let me tell you a little bit about her. I don't want to waste any time. Carol Howe is a close friend of Bill Thetford and an ACIM student and teacher for 32 years. She's known for her gift of clarifying and enlivening this spiritual practice, inspiring and uplifting those who seek peace of mind. She is just the most wonderful author, teacher, counselor, and lifelong student of universal principles. Carol's been a practitioner of A Course in Miracles since 1977, right around the time when it was first introduced to the world by Helen Schuckman and Mr. Bill Thetford. Known for her warmth and sense of humor, Carol brings a rich combination of skill, passion, and experience to all her work. In 2009, she published Never Forget to Laugh, Personal Recollections of Bill Thetford, co-scribe of A Course in Miracles. She's also authored several other books and numerous audio programs, and now has a new DVD series. I'm so excited about this. It's called See How Life Works, and it's the latest project in a long and productive career of offering relevant, life-altering guidance and insight for both course and non-course students alike. No matter where you are on your spiritual path, you will benefit by this series. So let's bring Carol on. Carol, are you there?
I surely am.
Hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. I'm sitting here smiling as if I'm looking at an audience. I'll probably wave my hands around in the air as if I'm teaching as well. I get
Go
a kick
ahead.
Out of that.
Go ahead. It's authentic. And they're there. I can see them.
That's
our
great.
Listeners are tuning in. Yes, they're there. And so tell us, what are you working on right now? What are you doing?
Well, our big exciting project now is a project called See How Life Works, and it's a DVD series. And I have to tell you, in case nobody has noticed yet, that since mm-hmm. my name is C period, of course, standing for Carol Howe, H-O-W-E, there's no way in the world that I could not use See How Life Works as
oh,
a title for
it.
Something like this. I could
That's
not
great.
Believe that the domain name was still available when we put up our website. So It's a series, 8 DVDs, professionally produced, the first mm-hmm. that we can find of anything about the course that's done, you know, with a several-camera shoot and proper editing and people who know what they're doing technically putting things together. So we thought this was worth doing it right, and we take some of the most basic principles and do one DVD about each one of those. And all 8 of them are filmed. 4 of them have been edited and released. We're editing the 5th one right now and hope to have the 5th and 6th one for sure out by the end of the year, and that leaves us 2 more to go. But we're very excited about them, and we've gotten fabulous feedback. So what
Excellent.
Can I say? We're having a wonderful time doing it. If nobody ever saw these, we've had so much fun putting them together. That's all that matters.
It sounds terrific. And what? Why now? What made this come about? What inspired it?
Well, I guess in the larger picture, it's time, because so many people are bereft. They don't have answers. They have no idea what they're doing, and are really looking for something that's meaningful. So right. you might say, cosmically, so far as specifically, my filming partner, who works for a friend of mine and a student and client of mine, suggested a couple of years ago, we're about to come up to our two-year anniversary, that we should collaborate. He's a filmmaker and very good, and we should put our skills together and bring this work forward.
Okay.
So he actually initiated it, and it's interesting because for about 10 years before that, I had thought these classes need to be videotaped, not just audio recorded, because I've got these big models that we might talk about later that have to be seen. That was the whole point
right.
of making those visual things.
Okay.
So that's how we got started, and boy, have we got a lot done in the past 2 years.
Fantastic. And so it's all based on A Course in Miracles principles,
correct? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
But however, although it's based on the principles of A Course in Miracles, by no means do you need to be a Course in Miracles student to derive benefit. Because although
okay.
it's alluded to, and occasionally some of the language used, not a lot, because the focus is on bringing the principles, the underlying, this is how this works, forward. And it doesn't matter what you're studying or not studying, you can derive great benefit from it.
Okay, so no matter what religious affiliation, no matter where you are on your path, like I said, you
Absolutely.
Can get something out of this. Okay, excellent, excellent. So, well, let's go back in time for a moment. As far as A Course in Miracles is concerned, in your words, what is A Course in Miracles for? Tell us your personal take on that.
Well, I would say my personal take on it is that A Course in Miracles can be labeled a transpersonal psychology, and that for some is not very helpful. So what I might then is use the language of the day, which is technical, and call it a spiritual technology. Many people, including myself in the beginning, are very confused about what it's for. They say, it's a course. Okay, it's like my algebra or chemistry course. I'm supposed to learn a bunch of stuff. And, of course, you look at that big book and you think, oh, dear, that's an awful lot of stuff I have to learn. It's not about learning more material, although, of course, you will learn a lot of material. But the point of the course is in its practice. And that's why the workbook is so very important, because as you practice, not read about, in the beginning people will say, okay, I'm going to read what this says, and okay, I've done my lesson for the day. It's putting it into practice. And what that does is to begin to reprogram us from the limited and unfortunate view that most of us have of ourselves. Often, much of that is unconscious, but this is a radical reprogramming of who we think we are, why we think we're here, how we think life works. So, so far as I can tell, having studied many, many things, it's the best there is in terms of really diving deeply into, we've got to undo the things that you believe about yourself. The course says this is not about learning anything. It's an unlearning technology. It doesn't use the word technology. I use that one. But it's about an unlearning of the untrue and unhelpful things that we believe that's driving our life experience.
And holding us back from experiencing peace.
I'm sorry?
And holding us back from experiencing peace, which is what we
Absolutely.
All want. Ask anybody, what do you want? And they can name people, places, and things, but what they really are looking for is peace.
Exactly. And you cannot have peace when you're frightened, when you're insecure, and when you've got enemies. So all of that needs to be addressed. How do I allow the things in my life to be friends and not enemies? How can I substantively see things differently? How can I employ a different part of my mind, so to speak?
Change your mind.
Specifically, you know, people will say, change your mind and change your life, which is exactly true. But a lot of people think, well, what does that really mean, change my mind? Well, what I have to change is, because of the way this is all, this is from the perspective of here we are in the world, which is certainly mm-hmm. where we appear to be, and nobody gets to the age of 5 or 6. Without having downloaded into their very being all sorts of things from the environment and where we live, how we live, the century we happen to live in, that are limiting, frightening, untrue, and it's too small. It's like trying to stick your foot in a size 3 shoe when you're an adult. It's painful. So it's about that's what specifically needs to be changed, or all of those ideas and notions that collectively, the sense of limiting belief that we call the ego. The ego is a nice handle to refer to that rat's nest of misinformation that's been around for so long, we presume that those things about us are true. And they aren't.
Well, I tend to say that, A, it becomes, yes, it's a practical course, and it has the information, you know, how to forgive, how to restructure your mind and undo all the misperceptions that we have. And
absolutely.
For me, it became a lifestyle of forgiveness and correcting my perceptions to perceive reality correctly.
Absolutely.
Once accomplished, life wasn't as complicated, it wasn't as mysterious, as painful, and I actually started to enjoy my life so much more. And the more you do it, the easier it is to get there, and the easier it is to stay there in that peaceful state of mind. So for me, it's a lifestyle as well as a learning tool, as well as a comfort when I am feeling down, if I'm having a moment of confusion or emotional disquiet. I can always turn to the text and find exactly what I need to hear.
I certainly agree with that. And it is the point is for it to become a lifestyle. We, unfortunately, most people are embedded in a lifestyle of fear, of a sense of threat, you know, that I'm always got to defend myself from this or promote myself this way. We learn many manipulative and negotiating strategies when we're little because, after all, we aren't operating with a full deck when we're little, when we come into the world. And so we do the best we can to survive. After all, we, like all other young animals, are trying to stay alive when we're very small. And we have to learn to negotiate with these very large people that seem to be responsible for our well-being, and in that process, we learn so many things about ourselves that aren't true, and they don't seem like beliefs, they feel like the truth, and so we need to begin to shift what our baseline beliefs are, and I can guarantee you that when that happens, what you just mentioned is things get easier, things get to be more fun. You just notice that people seem to be cooperative as a rule rather than that being the exception. And it's just a delightful way to live. And you might say, well, then why doesn't everybody just jump on the bandwagon? Well, fear, for one thing, gets in the way.
Fear.
But this is an unknown. I don't know how to live this way, and I don't know if it's safe or not.
Because the unfamiliar is frightening.
It is. It's kind of the devil you know as compared to the devil you don't know, and it's pretty silly to think that peace and love and joy and happiness and ease are going to be yet another devil. But the ego can present absolutely anything other than itself as something to stay away from.
That's
and
one
it
of
does.
Its greatest tools, yes. I think of it this way. I would think that most of us agree that in each of us is a spark of God, and we are all
no
connected.
Doubt.
Okay. Sometimes I think of the ego, so as people, when you say ego, people start to immediately evaluate their own ego and try to determine its size when there is no size. And, you know, they'll say, well, so-and-so has a bigger ego than I do. So I say this, picture all of humanity, and then picture a dark cloud hovering over our heads, and that's the ego. As it pertains to our own egos, it's just that the ego knows your personality well enough and the inner workings of your mind to determine what you are most hopeful for and most afraid of, and knows how to use it against you.
It's one of the most startling things is to come to a realization from your experience, not just because you've read the words, that the ego mind, which is simply just a big belief structure matrix, so to speak, that presents itself as your friend and guide, and I'm going to get you through this, and so on, is both treacherous, vicious, and not your friend.
It
presents
not.
Itself as your friend, and it most certainly isn't, because it always promotes conflict. The ego
yes.
cannot survive with conflict. It can't survive if you move to a place of peace. So it's all about disrupting peace.
It'll starve, and it's all about self-preservation through
mm-hmm.
your destruction. And,
right.
And in destroying you, it gets to live. And it my favorite quote, and what I constantly remind myself, if I find myself striving for something, not so much patiently working toward, if I'm not in a place of peace, if I'm striving, I remind myself, the ego, as it states in the Course, will forever have you chasing what it does not want you to find.
Mm-hmm.
So for many who have been introduced to this and quickly rejected it, it's because you had the answers in your hands, and that's the ego's function, is to
mm-hmm.
have you chasing after things that will not give you a sense of fulfillment. And to anyone that has happened to it, I've heard so many stories about people slamming the book shut, putting it into the closet, locking the door, very extreme reactions to it. But I would say, give it a try. You never know. And it still might be the answer that you're looking for deep down. Just don't let your mind steer you away from what could potentially change your life, as it's done for mine, and I'm sure yours, and millions of other people around the world.
I always tell any new students who go through a little honeymoon period of, wow, this is the most wonderful material, and it is, and I did too, and still do. I'm still
mm-hmm.
in love with this material. I think it gets better and better and better every day. But
mm-hmm.
what it's designed to do is bring up into conscious awareness a lot of painful stuff. And it will start right away. And so people start to feel some distress or some confusion or whatever, and they think, well, I don't know what this is about, but this is not for me. And you think, oh, dear, in fact, it is for you. That's the whole
yeah.
point of this, is to
yeah.
bring up things that we believe, distressful feelings. It doesn't just bring up thoughts. It brings up the feelings that are associated with it,
mm-hmm.
because only when you become aware of what's really driving you can you change your mind. How in the world are you going to change your mind about factors of which you are completely unaware, and yet they're driving the bus?
And they're all based in the past, which are now, it's now
yeah.
rendered an illusion. So your motivators are false, and we wonder why we're unhappy.
And the other thing that people say, I can't read this book. This is like reading Russian. When I start a sentence, by the time I get to the end of a sentence, I don't know what the first part said. You know why?
That's the
ego.
And
people say, why is this written in such a complicated way? It's not written in a complicated way, but you're reading in the beginning, obviously. We're reading this material and dealing with it through the eyes of the ego. And
mm-hmm.
since this is about the undoing, so to speak, or the moving
mm-hmm.
our allegiance away from the ego, this looks like gibberish. In fact, in one of our DVD classes, one of the students, one of the ones we filmed, he said, it seems like the latter part of the text is written in more simple language than the earlier part. And he's not talking about just chapter 31 versus chapter 1. He's talking about just generically. I said, it's all written basically the same way,
yeah,
except that you're reading it through with a clearer mind. And
exactly.
So it seems easier. Of course it's easier. The more clarity we have, the more obvious all this becomes.
Yes. And I have experienced getting to the bottom of a page, turning the page, and forgetting everything I just read. So I went back, and I read it again, and I continued to reread it until I could learn the technique of relinquishing my ego to the extent that I could set it aside and absorb the material through true spiritual sight and integrate
mm-hmm.
it deeply, and then that stopped happening as often. When I do catch it, I know what's doing it, and I know I need to relinquish my ego a little more to just embrace the text that I know I need so deeply. And so that's what I do. I have a little technique. Maybe later in the show I'll kind of demonstrate that for everybody. But I'm dying to ask you. In the beginning, tell us about your association with this entire phenomenon, I'll call it, in the very beginning, you were actually friends with the eternally brilliant Dr. Bill Thetford, who worked with Helen Schuckman, and co-scribed all of this material, all the everything.
But absolutely.
Just start from the beginning, and I'm just going to step back and enjoy listening to you talk.
Well, the course, as you may or may not know, was published in the summer in June of 1976, and I encountered it in 1977 and immediately ordered it and thought it was just the most amazing material that I could find. It was the first year my children were both in school for the full school day, and I just couldn't get enough of it. You know, as much time as I could while they were gone, I was had my nose in this book. And it took me about 9 months to convince enough friends of mine to read this book. They would open it, and they would look at the language, and they would look at the size and say, nope. But finally, there were 14 of us that started a little group. Well, as that group was beginning to meet, which would have been the summer of 1978, earlier in that year, in May, I lived in Denver at the time, and I received a flyer in the mail from the Humanistic Psychology Conference indicating that they were having a big meeting at one of the colleges in Denver, and that Judy Scutch, that's before she married Whitson, that Judy Scutch, the publisher of the course and part of the Foundation for Inner Peace, was going to be in Denver lecturing, and that Bill Thetford was going to be with her, although he would not be on the podium. Well, I would have gone on my knees to the other side of town to listen to her, and so we did. And here was the strange thing. Here was the cosmic setup. The program was set up outside at Regis College. Well, outside in May in Denver is still cold, can be cold, but the brochure didn't say it was going to be outside. So I showed up with probably a lightweight sweater or something, and the chairs were outside and a portable stage outside, and Judy is a perfectly marvelous presenter. She's excellent. So she was so engaging to listen to, but pretty soon I thought I would freeze to death. I thought I'm just going to get up and leave. So I looked around for the nearest door I could see to go inside, so I headed for that door. I opened it up, and here's one lone man standing by himself. And I instantly knew it was Bill Thetford.
Oh, my God.
And we instantly recognized one another from wherever. I couldn't say with any, except we recognized each other as long-lost friends or soulmates or something. So
it's you.
Yes, he and I. And so we talked for about 10 minutes, and about that time they dismissed the program early because everybody else was freezing to death too, and pretty soon the place was filled with people. And I did not know what to do with this experience of such a deep sense of recognition of, I know this person. So I didn't know what to do about it, so I did nothing at all. And over that summer, I was starting to do little groups and so on, trying to get a group through these chapters. And so we went through by chapters because I didn't know how else to do it at the time. And someone called in the summer and said, did you know that Bill Thetford and the Scutches have moved to Tiburon? And I thought, where's Tiburon?
Yeah.
So I found out that it's in Marin County across from San Francisco, and I thought, okay, so I just filed that information away as really irrelevant information, but it was filed away nonetheless.
Okay.
And then a very dear friend of mine with whom I facilitated course groups, he was a rolfer, if people recognize rolfing, deep tissue massage therapy, and he called me and he said, I'm going to Tiburon, of all places, to do some advanced training. I'll tell you, when he said that, I could hear, it seemed like, Bill's voice in my mind saying, come out, come out. And I thought, this can't be possible. I only knew this man for 10 minutes. And I was really quite taken with all of that, still didn't know what to do about it.
Right.
And then I decided to write him a letter on Jason's behalf and say, and just send it to the Foundation for Inner Peace, because how else would you possibly address anything to somebody you don't know?
right.
And hoped that he would have a chance to meet Jason. And to my amazement, to my astonishment, this is way before caller ID, on Halloween afternoon of 1978, I'm getting my little kids dressed to go out for their Halloween festivities.
Right.
And it's Bill Thetford.
No.
And he said, I got your letter.
Oh,
I would
God.
Be delighted to meet Jason, and will you come out too? And I was just floored.
So this must have been like that first 10-minute meeting. I assume this felt similar. I'm asking for my own, because I can feel as you're talking, I can kind of see and feel a lot of this. Did it feel to you like time shifted and you had a different perception of time and yourself and him?
At first I said, oh, no, I was being polite or weird or scared or something. And said, well, no, this is just a letter of introduction for Jason. And by the next morning I thought, have I lost my mind?
Oh, my
of course
God.
I'm going out. And
you thought
so
you were
we
doing something nice for Jason.
That was my original intent, literally.
I just thought,
well, he's going to be out there. I would love for him to meet this man. And we were both devoted students of the course. That all seemed reasonable. But it was shocking. And so we found a time in November of 1978. So Jason was already out there. I went out. We had a mutual friend with whom I stayed. And so I was there for 5 days and met Judy and Bob Scutch and Francis and Roger and Jerry Jampolsky and all the people who make up, you might say, the first family of A Course in Miracles. And
Jerry was there too?
Oh, yes. Everybody was there. And I was just quite overwhelmed by their very loving acceptance. And Judy looked at me one night when Jason and I were over at their house, and she looked at me and she said, I know why you're here. Bill needs to be socialized, you know, after his years and years and years of working so hard. And she said, I bequeath you Bill, because she always regarded Bill as her dearest friend and colleague and so on. But she said, I bequeath you Bill. Bill needs to have some other kinds of experience. I don't know how she elaborated on that, but my head was spinning at the idea that I had been bequeathed Bill, so to speak, to befriend and be helpful to in whatever way I could. And obviously it was mutual. So it started from there. And he would come stay with us, my family, in Denver, and I would go stay with him. For those who don't know, Bill is a gay man, and so my husband did not find that threatening, and so no muss, no fuss about that.
Okay,
and
so that's why your husband didn't have a problem with you spending time with him.
No.
Okay.
No.
That's
and when I had worked for IBM years before, I ended up doing a lot of traveling, and most people who worked for IBM at that time were men, so he was used to my traveling around, and, you know, it was a non-issue.
Right.
But it was marvelous to meet everybody and to see the tiny little steps that were taken in the beginning, and, of course, to have watched what's happened over all these decades.
And now at this point where Judy says, I bequeath you Bill, this is now at the beginning of his retirement, was it not?
This was, he had taken, once the course was finished, and Helen was, he had managed to keep her on past the, what at that time was required retirement age of 65. Bill was 14 years younger than Helen. So he had managed to keep her on a little bit longer until they could get the course finished, and those 12 copies made and put in binders and locked in the bottom of his file cabinet, because he couldn't imagine that there would be more than 12 people in the world who would possibly be interested in this. So he sat there, and in the process of winding down their time, of course, they met Judy as was meant to be, and she's vivacious and organized and knows how to get everything in the world done, and so it was appropriate that they bequeath to the Foundation for Inner Peace the copyright to the material, and they all became fast friends. But once you've been involved, as Bill was, for 20 years or so,
Yeah.
Well, he was at Columbia for 20 years, but by the time he had been for about a 10-year spiritual overhaul in the process of bringing this material forward, you can't just say, okay, I wash my hands of that, now I'll go back to just merely doing research and being a professor. That was completely out of the question. So he first of all took a sabbatical, and then he took a leave of absence. In other words, he did whatever, and then the university said, decide, are you going to be employed here or not? And that was a scary time for him because he, I mean, at least a little bit scary.
He knew. Okay.
And that was where he associated, of course, his financial security plus what people don't know. There's so many things people don't know about him, which is why I wrote his biography. Bill was a very famous guy in his field in his own right.
That's what I wanted to get to. Most of us, I think I can safely speak for a lot of students and teachers, most of us see Bill, we see Helen in the forefront, and we see Bill in the background, which I don't feel is the case in reading your book, and we see him as the guy who typed it up, which I think is a terrible understatement.
It's a ghastly understatement
for us.
On all sorts of levels. It's a gross misunderstanding of their relationship. First of all, as I say, Bill was a very famous guy there in the area of personality research and so on, in the whole field of psychology and psychiatry. His name was a household word. You know, he often appeared written up in columns in the New York Times and so on, and they were sought out. He and Helen, because he brought Helen into the picture early on once he went up there, they were sought out by people in their field and considered the people at pretty much the top of the food chain. Well, does anybody know that about them? No.
Nobody. No.
Nobody. And the second thing is he was a brilliant, brilliant man. And he was a very funny man. And he was a very humble man. And the idea that he was the helper, here's what people miss. And since I'm experiencing this to a very large degree with this See How Life Works project that we're working on now, it was the joining of their energies. It was their common commitment. It's as if they were the parents that brought forth this baby.
Yes.
Now, granted, it appears that the mother has the baby, but it's real hard to have a baby with no father, you know, regardless of how you might want to put that around. So not only was he energetically every bit as much responsible as she was, without his constant patience and being there for her, this was very hard for her. And when she would bring in her notes from the night before, He said sometimes he would have to type with one hand and hold her hand with the other. She would cry. She would stutter. She would cough. She would lose her voice. It was so frightening to her to have to say these words out loud because they were antithetical to anything she believed.
And she was having physical reactions to the whole process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, having physical reactions.
Very, very
so it wasn't just at that metaphysical energy level, whatever you want to call that, that they were joined. They both said that they recognized early on that they had made a commitment to this before they came into this life. Whatever anybody wants to believe about that doesn't really matter, except they recognized a joint commitment. You don't have to worry about from whence came the joint commitment, but they certainly recognized it. And the thing that was fascinating is that when they had a ghastly relationship. It was acrimonious. Everything was a war for them. They were constantly at war in all of their academic pursuits, and except when they were working on the course. And when they were working on the course, they were the poster children for respect, for understanding, for compassion, for love, for patience. It's as if they had made a determination, no matter what, we will not ruin this work that's ours to do. And so they would finish with that and then go back to their regular academic work, and they would take up their swords again.
Oh, my goodness.
And if there is anything that gives us the example that conflict is a choice, that surely must be it. And, of course, by the end of Bill's life, he practiced so thoroughly. And of course, when he came to California, that represented his change of geography, represented a big mind shift that was
yes.
occurring as he was coming to the end of his time in New York.
Yeah, that makes
exactly.
sense.
And that shift in perception, so that you might say his own practice, his own letting go, his own forgiveness. And he said, you know, forgiveness is what it's all about. And his, shall we say, his dropping away of his own unfortunate beliefs escalated exponentially that last 10 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing to watch. He just got lighter and funnier, if that's possible. He was a very funny guy. But
yeah.
you could see him become more relaxed and easier within himself.
And
it was
to
just,
to read about his childhood, how, that very difficult childhood, very isolated, to give people an idea, I'm pretty much halfway through the book, Never Forget to Laugh. And that, it's interesting. And I want everybody to read this book. I mean, to know more about this man has been such a remarkable journey for me, because he was such an enigma, and Helen as well. But something about Bill is I'm drawn to Bill, and to see that his childhood he endured such sickness and such isolation, it's no wonder that he went into the psychology field to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm reading and as I look at his life. To spend all that time, all that money, and all that effort pursuing a dream of understanding the ego and the personality and how it's built and constructed
mm-hmm.
in many facets, and then for this to come out of, I'll say, both of their psyches, and to sit down and read that and then learn that everything you've devoted your entire life to is an illusion, that must have been mind-blowing and heartbreaking.
It was to after once he got started, and he was one of the handful. I mean, there were only probably two or three people in the world who understood how the ego develops as thoroughly as Bill did. So look at the irony of this.
Yes.
One of the world's experts, you could probably safely call him the world's expert in how
yes.
this happens, is now the one who brings about its undoing. And it became finally impossible to continue his research. The thing that was very schizophrenic for them was that while the course was coming, and in that period of time that comprised both the 7 years of its dictation plus the three or so that it was involved with the editing. For the
mm-hmm.
earlier part of that, he's still getting grant money, and they're still doing research on the personality assessment system and so on. And then, in the other part of his life, he's busy writing away, and they're busy formatting and checking, and he then begins to try to practice what in the world this material is all about. And finally,
right.
the disparity between focusing on how it comes and practicing letting it go became an impossible thing to uphold, and so he gave up his research. But he considered his research, the psychology part of him, considered
mm-hmm.
his research his greatest gift to the world of psychology. Now, how many course students know that?
None. I don't.
I've never
heard any of this.
And the thing that I hear from so many people who have read this, first of all, they cry, usually, and if they call by phone or something, or they report how they wept, how they could see themselves in his journey. And that was the whole point, not only to give you some idea of what his life was about, but he has to walk the same path we all have to walk. And
that's
so
cool,
the one most common thing that I think I have heard from people is, I so feel like I got to know Bill.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, but he was my friend too. So
oh.
it was, and he is, everybody's friend too. I'm going to say is present tense rather than past tense because he is.
It definitely feels that way, and I'm noticing a lot of similarities in both of our personalities. My interest, my childhood, my interest, my past, and I think that anybody who reads this book, as you, especially from the perspective of A Course in Miracles, and having been forced by A Course in Miracles to look at your life and look at yourself and your psyche, and this is what we have to do in order to change it and change our perception. But to watch his life step by step lead him to the Course,
yes,
I think provides a softer way for the rest of us to gain a willingness to look at our own lives and look at the steps that led us here today.
Well, I hope so, because he had such a happy ending. He really moved into an enlightened state. When he moved to, sometimes I would be at parties and stuff with him, and people would come up to him and, you know, who knew who he was, and when he was newly there in California, and they'd say, well, you know, Dr. Thetford, or if they knew him better, Bill, so what are you doing now that you're retired? Since he had obviously finally taken early retirement. And he would say, I'm practicing forgiveness. and most people would look like, what? You know, is that supposed to be
that
a smart aleck answer? But he was being very serious. And as far as he was concerned, that was job one. And whatever else happened was whatever else happened. But that constant focus on letting go of the stories that we hold about ourselves and others, which become the excuse for not loving.
Right.
And, of course, miracles are about, you might say, shifting the way we see those things, shifting the way we tell those stories so that the lovingness that we are becomes apparent. And so that our inclination is to finally, once and for all, allow us to be as we were created, which is extensions of love with the singular need of extending love ourselves. But the ego promotes all these stories that says, well, I can't love this person, and that person's a mess. And so it promotes non-love because it's out of a job. Once we come back to that full recognition of what we are, and I'll tell you, people were healed around him. Not because he did any magic, but because some people would say, for the first time in my life, I really felt okay. He was so good at not judging people. He just would no more consider judging or deciding you needed to be fixed or anything. And if anybody
condemning.
Ever asked him, he never did that. So people had healings, they had breakthroughs, they had all sorts of things just by somehow being in his presence. And I understand that because without fail, every single time we got together, whether it was in Tiburon or Denver or sometime, there were a few times we lectured together out in California so we could be someplace else in California. And within about 48 hours after I would go back home or he would leave, depending on where we were, I would have this feeling of being bigger, of being more. And it was very subjective, so if I had to explain to anybody more of what, it would be, well, everything in general and nothing in particular. In other words, it was just I could feel being more myself. And it was,
I get it.
He was an amazing gift. And so I find, and I don't know how and you don't need to know a thing about Bill or Helen to deeply appreciate and find the Course valuable. I mean, you certainly don't need to know that.
Sure.
But I find that it's even more fascinating when you know how it came to be. And about the people who struggled so hard to bring it forward. Bill used to say, if you think studying or reading or practicing this course is hard, you should have seen what it was like trying to get it here in the first place.
Trying to get it down on paper.
Yeah, tried the process that they put themselves through and just
daily.
the the daily grind that they put themselves through. They didn't have to, but they did.
It's not like they had a whole lot of free time on their hands. They were in very high positions at the university. He was, what, the department head?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. He was head of all the medical psychology. He had about three different jobs or more. He was head of all the medical psychology at Presbyterian Hospital, which is the teaching hospital that's associated with Columbia University. And he had administrative functions. He had honors graduate students that he was responsible for. It's as if every new thing that came along, they said, well, this can be your job too.
So. Yeah, and they kept throwing things onto him. And even before he got there, he was involved in the FBI. And
yes. Well, he was involved with the CIA, FBI. Which is different.
Oh, CIA? Oh, different? Okay.
It's very different, and it's important that you brought that up because there is some malicious material, I consider it malicious, on the Internet about Bill and the CIA with entirely incorrect information, that he was involved in various projects that had to do with mind control and so on and so forth. He never was. He was always in the research area. He was never in an operational area. And I interviewed three of his CIA colleagues, if you can imagine, that I was able to track them down after all these years. No. So they're all in their 90s now. Some of them are not even. One guy I interviewed died shortly afterwards. And so we not only have it from the people who were his colleagues, but from his paymaster, the person who was continuing to fund the personality assessment system research when he was at Columbia. And everybody to a person says, absolutely not. He was research-oriented, nothing else. So there's terrible stuff. I mean, I think it's terrible because it paints him as in the first place, the CIA at that time was very different from what the CIA is today. They were not even recognizably the same. This was a little, small, underfunded operation when he was involved as a 28-year-old kid.
Just looking at his pictures, and you include pictures of him in the book, beautiful pictures, and just to look at him, and you can get a feel, he would have nothing to do with mind control. He was trying to figure out his own mind so he could help other people figure out their mind.
Absolutely.
And I think that makes him the perfect candidate to be the father of this project. And
yes, everything in the world made him the perfect father of this. And much I do now, down through the ages, so to speak, is at Bill's suggestion. Bill would come to my classes. This was very weird.
Really?
The first time it happened, I thought, well, this has got to be one of the strangest circumstances that I can imagine because at this point, my friend Jason and I were teaching six-week overview classes of the course because people would say, I want to read this course, but I cannot make heads or tails of it. So I thought, if I could figure out how to teach an overview class where people could say, I could say, here's what it's for, here's how it works, here's what to expect, here are the major ideas, then maybe if they started to read it, it would be easier. It was just an experiment, but it was an experiment that worked because people would say, oh, yeah, now I can read this. So when one of the first times that Bill came to Denver, our little classes were on Thursday night, and we said, well, Bill, do you want to stay home and wait for us to come back, or do you want to come with us? He said, well, I want to come with you, but don't tell anybody who I am.
So what did he do, sit in the back of the room?
No, he didn't sit in the back. He just sat kind of in the middle, and like this big light is beaming in the middle. And I said, okay, it was hard to focus. Let me tell you what. It was hard to focus with Bill sitting there, but he...
No doubt.
He said he got a lot out of it. But here was the funny thing. I said, I won't tell anybody, but I guarantee that before the evening is over, somebody's going to figure you out. And sure enough, because it was a long class, it was from 7:30 to 10, so we'd have a little break in the middle, and people would come up and say, who is that guy? And I said, he's a friend of ours visiting from out of town. His name's Bill. I mean, Bill is a nice, common name. And they would start to talk to him, and because he had such presence. Even when he was struggling back in his earlier days, he still had that very amazing, loving, healing presence about him, which I don't think he got until maybe close to the end of his life, the influence that he had on people. So if people would start to ask him questions during the break, and of course he wasn't going to lie to them and say something that wasn't true, so the cat would come out of the bag.
Right.
And they would just say he's so amazing. And you know what was really funny? About 3 years ago, I did a workshop in Denver where all of this took place.
Really?
There was some commentary about Bill, and a lady raised her hand, and I was mentioning these qualities about Bill. This was, I think the workshop was based on the book. It was right after it was released. And this lady raised her hand, and she said, "My name is so-and-so." She said, "You were my first teacher. I was in one of your classes when Bill was there." And it was so fun to have, you know, an independent somebody. And she said, "When I hugged him goodbye when the class was over with, mm-hmm. I've never had a feeling like that. It was just a feeling I had never had before of being so accepted." So
wow.
I love that somebody just appeared as a plant in that class, so to speak, to verify, you know, indeed, he was an amazing guy. So, yes, that was very, it was harder to teach a class with him in the class than when we taught together. I mean, there was something different about the dynamic of that. He hated to speak in front of more than about five people, and he was fabulous at it, but it was very anxiety-producing for him. He didn't like to do it, but he occasionally did.
Some people aren't built that way, but he had that critical ingredient. I'll say, number one, I think he had that critical ingredient of non-judgment and the loving quality and the big heart to go with it. And when you look at somebody as your mentor and they suddenly put themselves in the chair or on the floor and you're standing and they're looking up at you to teach them, that is nerve-wracking.
Definitely nerve-wracking. And then it got easier after a while because that happened,
sure you
know, a handful of times. But the first time, I have to tell you, that was a stretch. But Bill was always very supportive of anything I did, and I feel positive because of some of the things that have occurred, some of the inexplicable things that have occurred in the process of putting this DVD series together. I will just never be unconvinced that Bill's not standing there in the wings cheering on the process.
Yes, and
I'm convinced of that.
I was getting an image when you said he was, you know, he sat in the middle of the room and I could see him almost like a faint smile and him saying, "You can do it, you can do it. Forget about me." And I'm sure you did. And so how many years did you research this? Because this is so thorough. And like you said, you found co-workers from the CIA, you found friends, you found partners. How many years did the research go on?
Well, I actually did a little of this research long before that. I did a few of the interviews long before I started on this one, but in the fall of 2006, I started forming in my mind a lot of the various things, making lists of all the things that I could remember, of all the things we did and things about him and so on. And then in 2007, in the early-ish part of 2007, I started interviewing people. And, oh, my goodness, what a process that was, because I interviewed about 30 people, and all of whom knew him well, because it seemed to me to present the most comprehensive picture of Bill, it required talking to people who were students of the course and close friends of his. So all of the people I interviewed were related with him in some way.
And by the time I transcribed
all that stuff and then lifted the parts that I wanted to make whatever point was needing to be made from all of that, it was pretty nonstop. I mean, I had a grandchild in there somewhere along the way and so on, but it was a pretty nonstop 2 years. Especially because there's so many endnotes, since it's a scholarly work as well as many other things. You know, all of those endnotes, I think it took me 6 weeks just to create the list of endnotes and put them all in the Chicago Manual of Style format, you know,
right.
So that
it's brilliant. It's brilliant because what I do as I'm reading each chapter, I put my finger in the endnotes, so I can go right to the endnote for that chapter to see what the source was as you quote it. And it's funny, earlier today I wanted to read a little bit more. I'm reading this as fast as I can. I cannot get enough of it, and I do feel like I'm getting to know him. And I just want to say, I would be remiss. What everybody might not know is that July 4th marked the 25th anniversary of Dr. Sepper's death. And so I just want to say to you, Carol, I am very, very sorry for the loss of your friend. And
well, I certainly experienced the 4th of July differently now, but it must be said that the night before, he was living in the San Diego area for the last couple of years of his life, but he would come up to Tiburon every mm-hmm. couple of months, and because that's where his, you might say, most original first family still was, and
yeah,
most
circle.
Of them. And so he came up on the 3rd of July and had dinner with Jerry and another mutual friend of theirs. Diane was out of town. And Jerry was just, who picked him up at the airport, was just quite overwhelmed with, because Bill had been getting lighter and lighter and lighter and bigger and more and more who he was, but something had happened that really it was just off the charts. He was so happy and so joyous and so free and so on and so forth. And so they went to dinner that night, and Jerry delivered him back to the Whitson's house, Judy and Whit. And mm-hmm. the next morning they had a very long, lovely breakfast, and Judy was having 35 or 40 people over for dinner and fireworks and to see Bill, all people who were all friends of his. And after breakfast, she said, "Oh, I'm going to go to the store and get a little bit more food." And Bill said, "You don't need any more food. You've got plenty of food." And she said, "I know, but I'm a good Jewish mother, so I've got to have extra." So
okay.
he said, "Okay." Now, what Bill always did after breakfast, no matter where he was, he always took a long walk after breakfast. So he said, "I will walk up to the market." And, of course, Judy was going to be driving. And he said, "Now, if you're ready to go home before I get there, you just come on home and I'll get home." And she had this very strange, it was kind of unsettling to her. She said, "Bill,
I almost don't want to know.
I would never come home without you." And she was thinking home with a capital H. I will always be with you at home, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
he walked out the door, up the street. She collected her purse and her car keys and her list and her whatever, and 2 minutes or so later, back out her driveway, started up the street. And there was Bill dead on the sidewalk.
No,
he had gotten to the next door neighbor, to the front of the next door, and the next door neighbor happened to be outside trimming his trees. So he was a surgeon. Don't know why he was trimming his trees, but he was. And he saw Bill go down. He said he had a massive heart attack as he was walking. So it was not the fall that killed him. It was his heart literally blew out. And he said he was dead instantly, no pain, no muss, no fuss.
Good.
And Bill had been saying, when Judy would say, "You do remember this is the 4th of July," and he would say, "Yes, this is my Independence Day." Everybody remembered his saying, "Today is my Independence Day." Now, nobody will ever know, at a conscious level, at an unconscious level, if he knew that was going to happen or not, but it is absolutely verifiably on record that he was said way more than once, "Today is my Independence Day."
I believe wholeheartedly, because I've seen it prior to people dying. Sometimes they go around saying goodbye to people, and they themselves mm-hmm. don't know why.
Yeah.
At soul level, you know. And you prepare for that, and maybe something is said. And I would think that there is a need for you to hear, "Today is my Independence Day," several times, so that it's stuck in everybody's mind to ease the shock of the physical passing, and
mm-hmm.
embrace the knowingness and the totality of his life, and be okay, and be okay with that as friends, and as, you know, I mean, it, basically he was your responsibility. He was bequeathed to you, and you have a sense of duty to nurture this man.
I did.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure there was some guilt, like, why wasn't I there? And Judy must have felt terrible.
Oh, Judy was beside herself. In other words, if people were supposed to get the message, I'm really leaving today, they didn't get it because everybody went into shock on finding this out. And anyway, he was an amazing guy. He was absolutely
was
without a doubt there would be no Course in Miracles. I don't know what else there might be, but there would not be this Course in Miracles without Bill and Helen coming together. And and I feel like it's that energetic agreement to do what we have signed up to do, so to speak, even if we don't
Absolutely.
Have any idea where or when we signed it up. And it feels so much to me like Robert and I have signed up to do this DVD series that we're doing now.
Yes, it feels
very much like somehow we've promised to do this.
Yes.
And we don't know where all it's going to go or, you know, what will happen next since we're still in the editing process right now. But
right.
it has felt so right, and never in my life have I engaged in a project where everything was so smooth, was so easy, everything we needed was immediately there. It has been astonishing. It has been nothing
effortless.
Less than astonishing. Completely effortless. And we've had, I'm sort of a project manager at heart, so there's been a lot of stuff to organize about this. Where is it going to happen?
Yes.
Putting together a class, having all the filming arrangements made. And if one person at the last minute called up and said, oh my gosh, my wife and I are sick, these were a couple of members of the class, and I had 15 minutes notice. 5 minutes later, another couple who thought they weren't going to be there, so I had replaced them, walked in and said, oh my gosh, we ended our other engagement early, here we are. They were going to sit in the gallery because we had people off camera there as well. And it's like, well, we just
right.
hope you come up here and sit in your chairs. And it was that kind of effortlessness. And in fact,
yes.
to the such a tiny degree, I think this is hilarious. I have to tell you this. When we filmed,
sure.
we were filming the seventh DVD. And as we were preparing, we've got this big pile of stuff on the porch of the place where we're doing the filming, waiting for the security guy to come. We've got all of the pieces of these big teaching models that I use, which is why
mm-hmm.
we had to film them rather than just do a CD of some kind. And all the filming equipment and boxes of stuff and things. And the woman who's my production assistant came over, and in one of the boxes I had one of those great big swimming pool noodles. You
yeah.
know what I'm talking about, made out of styrofoam that you use to play with in swimming pools and the ocean and so on.
Oh, no, I still use them. I still use them. I'm a terrible swimmer.
And she said, what is that for? Are you? And people should know by this time I always bring all sorts of props, but she was just joking, and she said, well, what's that for? Are you going swimming? And I said, no, I need it for an example of something that I'm going to use. And I had taken this bungee cord with a couple of S-hooks at the end and tried to hook the two ends together. I'm not
right.
very mechanically inclined. That was the best
okay.
I could do. And she said, do you need a noodle connector? I said, a noodle connector? I don't think I knew there was such a thing as a noodle connector. And she said, yeah, it's one of these little things. It's like it's something, and you just stick the two ends of the noodle in, and it kind of pulls against the rough edges, and it holds it in place. And she said, I have one in my car. She said, I
oh
never
my God.
Go any place without my noodles and noodle connectors. So she went out to the trunk of her car. Now, we do live in Florida, you know, where we're surrounded by water. And
sure.
she came back with a noodle connector, and I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard
of. That's hilarious.
The universe provides even the tiniest little... I thought, she's got to be the only woman in the world who considers noodles and noodle connectors important enough to always have in the trunk of her car with her. I still think it's hilarious. And
it is hilarious.
But it was indicative of how smoothly things have functioned, how everything we've needed has fallen into place. And
yeah.
we would have to be brain dead not to get this is our mission.
But I can't
this
believe
is,
everything you're telling me, because I'm really shocked, because, number one, like I said, I'm a terrible swimmer for whatever reason, and I have noodles. And guess where I keep them?
In the trunk of your car?
In my car.
So, well, then, see, there must be two of you in all the world and not just one.
Okay. Well, that's the first thing. And the second thing is the way you're describing the way this project is unfolding is exactly how this radio show is unfolding. With from the day I got the idea, I saw a license plate. And that gave me the I look for signs in nature, in traffic patterns, and I'm always translating energy. And since I said, okay, I'll do it, and it feels like at whatever point I signed up to do this, and nothing has felt this right in a very long time in my life. Things have felt like I'm moving in the right direction, but not like this. And it has been absolutely effortless, things falling into place, meeting people, and it's just coming together, and it's just amazing. So I'm glad that's happening for your project and these DVDs. That is a hilarious story. Unbelievable. But
and you see, once you live more and more and more with that sense of the world is filled with friends, there's a sense of everything is provided as it's needed, and you think, you mean I could live that way all the time? This would be people, you might say, on the front end of their doing their coursework. It's like, yes, this is everybody's birthright. If you would be willing to trade in some of the beliefs that you so hold on to, you know, with that, you know, white knuckle grip, if you would be willing to start to let those go, this is the natural response. This is the natural what happens. The Course says that once letting go of your grievances and letting go of your stories that are the excuse to not love one another, because we want to love each other, and only those stories get in the way. You know, it says there's a lesson that says the ego traffics in, you know, in grievances and in the past and things like that. And and if we do that, then we're going to stay stuck. We're going to stay small. Things are going to seem hard, and then we're envious of those for whom life seems to be better. But it can be that way for all of us if we're just willing to be led by the hand through this letting go process. And then life working out easily becomes the norm. It's like, what? Of course, this is the way it does work when you get out of
really
the way.
It really does. It really works. Even in the worst of times, like 2010, I tell my students, I tell everybody and my clients, if you made it out of 2010 alive, you're doing okay. And I know that was the worst of it. I know that was the worst of it energetically, and things are a lot easier now. So if you ever wanted to attempt this course, now is the time to do it, because you'll have a much better chance of success with less obstacles in your way. And the universe will provide time and the environment for you to do this work. But Carol, speaking of stories, Carol, everybody says how funny Bill was. And so I just want to ask you, tell us what, in your mind, you consider the funniest thing he ever said or did. Was he a practical joker?
No, he wasn't a practical joker exactly in terms of anything that would ever be considered malicious or undermining or anything. You know, a lot of humor is based on an attack.
Yeah, I don't like that.
But Bill's wasn't. One of the things, and there's, I don't know how anybody could ever remember this, but he was a punster. He could make puns like nobody you ever heard. And so he could rearrange words and put words in your mouth you didn't even know you had there and so on that were hilarious. Well, he would also, this is the closest he came to being a trickster, so to speak, is that we would, I can remember any number of occasions, and so could the people that I interviewed, where, let's say, we would be having dinner. I mean, the world showed up in Tiburon once the Scutches moved out there, and the Course was firmly established as that was its home base, so to speak, now. And Jerry Jampolsky was like the Pied Piper between Judy and Jerry. Everybody wanted to come find out who they were and what they were doing and so on. They're both very charismatic, and Jerry was getting to be very famous at that point, having been on all the big-name TV circuits and so on with attitudinal healing stuff. But so a lot of people would come through, and we would, you know, have dinners and meetings and whatnot. Well, we would have been talking about something, you know, that would be private earlier. It's hard to convey how this works, but somebody who was feeling very self-important or something would be holding forth, and Bill would say something that the rest of the people wouldn't recognize as particularly strange or something, but we, like in this case, I would know it, and it would be so funny that, and yet you'd be in a position where you couldn't laugh, because nobody would know what in the world you were laughing at. And he would do that with any number of people. It was kind of like the inside joke kind of thing. But he was just funny to be around. He had a very dry sense of humor. And one of his favorite sayings was, when people would, you know, be all disturbed about something, he would say, and he would say this kindly. He wouldn't say this in a derisive manner. He would say, I know it's hopeless, just not serious. He was a master at being lighthearted about the world. Now, he had his moments when he would fall into a hole of upset of some kind, but when he was being in his right mind, he saw the world in a lighthearted way. You could not take things seriously around him, because he would just manage to come up with something that would be side-splitting, but it would be very specific to whatever that was. When the course was coming through, he was an associate editor, or not an associate, he was a co-editor of the Journal for Abnormal Psychology. And so papers would be submitted, and this is right in the thick of when they're taking down the course. And he used to laugh out loud when he would tell these stories. They would have to sometimes reject articles on the grounds that they were not sufficiently scientific. Well, he thought this was the most preposterous situation, you know, to be huddled in their little private offices, taking down this amazing metaphysical work, and yet having to reject things over here because they weren't sufficiently scientific. And he just thought that was hilarious. He saw all of the contradictions of the world not as awful or needing to be condemned or anything else. He just thought it was funny.
And what was his laugh like? Was it an infectious laugh, a low, a Twitter laugh?
A little of everything, depending on the circumstances. He was not a great hearty laughter, you know, like some, like you think of with associated with certain body types, you know. But he was a tall, slender guy. But he was known for his humor, not necessarily his laugh, although it was a funny laugh. Mm-hmm. But he was known for his voice. He had a beautiful voice. And there was something that was so healing and comforting and soothing about the quality of his voice. Mm. Everybody just wanted, it didn't matter what he had to say. He could recite the alphabet, but the sound of his voice was
soothing.
Beautiful.
Okay.
And he was a singer in his early days.
Yes. I found the section the other day where I guess everybody was in Tiburon getting together as they did. And he came up, or somebody came up with the idea of Course in Miracles, the musical.
Yes.
Well,
That was Jack Luckett down in... Course in Miracles thing was something that Judy and Helen and so on, they made that up when they were still in New York. But when he moved down to Southern California, Jack and Leo Luckett were very dear friends of his, and they spent a lot of time going to the theater and movies and all kinds of stuff. And Jack and Bill were both very sophisticated musically, and so one of them would start singing some well-known song, and then the next one would come up with the next and these would be like course lessons, so to speak. I mean, the principles of course lessons, and they would make them up out of phrases from well-known musicals. And I thought, if there's ever is a shame that something didn't get recorded, it would be that. But of course, they'd be driving home in the car doing this, so the idea of recording it didn't come into play. But what a shame that we wouldn't be able to hear some of that funny stuff that happened.
I was cracking up, and you know, you can almost see it happening in your mind, and Bill with the soft shoe dancing, first of all, Helen singing, and both of them having a beautiful voice to actually play with. And then and then Bill coming up with, "I hear voices, but no one's there," in an apparatus.
That's right.
"I hear voices, but the room is bare." I called people up to read that to them. I found that so hilarious.
That would be typical of how he would rewrite words to things, you know, to be appropriate to some funny version of what was happening. So
it made me feel like I wish I could have been there, because I could have jumped right in, like with something like, I could have said something like, you know, and I used to sing, so I could have been a contender, I think, and just come out with, "I want to dictate, but time is short. I got to bang out the psychology report," and just do a dance number. And I think Bill would have liked me for that, you know.
Oh, he absolutely, I would say, rather than would have, I think you could bring it into present tense and say does.
Oh, you know, that's
he
beautiful.
Does. He does,
that's,
he does, he
that's
does.
Beautiful.
You know, he's here for everybody, just like, you know, I'm convinced people say, "Oh, I found this course." Well, you know what? I think the course finds us.
Yes, it does.
When we're ready, the course finds us in no telling how many weird and strange ways. I can't even, if I had time, I would write a book about all the ways that people have stumbled into the course. I've got way too much to do in this lifetime, so I'll never do it, but I wish somebody would. It would be a great book.
I think that's an easy thing to do. If people have a place to send their stories, I'd be happy to format it. I'm fast.
Well, somebody needs to do that. As I say, I can't oversee that because I have endless other things to oversee. But
sure.
I just think the stories are so interesting. And so this is what I would want people to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. If the course has found you, you're ready for it.
You're ready, absolutely.
Well, no matter what you may think about that, and if you could revamp what you think this is about, and realize that this is a great, comforting, loving presence that's taking you by the hand, recognizing you won't like this, you won't understand it, it will be confusing to you, you'll misread it, and you'll misuse it, and all kinds of stuff, but that if you will let me walk you through this spiritual technology so that... So that these terribly too small things that you believe about yourself can steadily, one by one, be upgraded, be replaced, be so that your sense of yourself, as you let go of grievances and decide to see things differently and be in your right mind and so on and so forth, they gradually are eroded. And the more they are eroded, the clearer your mind is. In
Absolutely.
Other words, it's as if our minds are foggy because of our fear, because of our grievances, because of our lack of understanding. So this is a clearing process. One of the most important sentences is in the introduction, where it says, "This course is not about teaching the meaning of love, because certainly that's beyond what can be taught.
Beyond comprehension.
It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence."
Yeah.
Love is present, always, already, now.
Yeah.
But we aren't aware of it. And so this course is to help clear away everything that keeps us unaware. It's a benign course. It's very deep. It's profound.
Very.
It's rich. And you will sometimes feel like you're just being scoured out. But it's not us. It's the ego that feels so threatened by this, because your allegiance is being drawn away from it. Your allegiance is finally going to be moved from a faith in separation and conflict and being repositioned so that your faith in your safety, what helps you, what makes life work for you, is joining. It's coming together. It's loving. Rather than separating and hating.
Right. And if you're tired, if it has found you and you're tired of being afraid all the time, it's a new millennium. Let it go.
Yeah.
And get into the course and properly apply it. It will change your life, because it will change your mind. It will undo
absolutely.
Other perceptions and restructure so that you are thinking clearly, thinking creatively, and not thinking about the past, because 99% of all thoughts are about the past, and that is gone, and it cannot hurt you anymore. But, yes, I mean, I love this course. It literally saved my life, I think, and it is my life. But you know what, Carol? We have a couple callers on the line. Are you open to taking a couple calls?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right,
you
let's
bet.
See who we have. Okay, hang on. Thank you for calling Spiritual Insights. You're on the air. What's your name? Hello?
Oh, hi. Sorry, it's Doug. Doug Anderson.
Hi, Doug.
Hi,
Char. How are
you? Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Sorry.
Hi.
I got the clue when it said you're unmuted, and I'm going, is that me?
The course is going to allow you to be unmuted.
Yeah.
There you go. So go ahead, Bill. You're on the air with Carol.
Yeah. Carol, thanks so much for
Doug.
Sharing yourself today. I'm a student, and I also a facilitator of the course. And I, you know, I had a couple of questions, but one of the things that really stood out is when you're talking about Bill and about just when in his presence how people would shift.
Yes.
And I think part of the way through this call that he actually came in and is part of this whole session today.
How marvelous.
You know, I just feel that shift that's happening in me with listening to you and being part of the show. And so I think everybody... and I know it's not really a question, but it's just kind of an awareness that I think we're all being touched by him just by being here and being together. So first of all, I think that's a
brilliant comment, and I do believe it. I mean, it's not the kind of thing I could prove, but I think he's promised to be with those who do their part in trying to become aware.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just, like, thank you so much. And there's like a couple of things that I'm always looking when facilitating, and people get up against their grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's just so hard for a student to let go of a grievance. And so I found some easier ways through when I'm coaching or if I'm...
Wonderful.
You know, but I'm just wondering if you've got some tips, like some of the things that you found. Like, you know, when someone just hits that wall and they understand forgiveness and they understand that, you know, putting down the grievance on the other side of that will be peace, but they just can't drop that grievance. And some of the, say, like the, some things that you've worked with that's helped people through there.
Well, one of the things I would ask somebody is, what's the threat that's associated with letting go of this grievance? In other words, what do you think is going to happen to you? And sometimes those kinds of questions will open up a dialogue that will let you see, you know, what the person is afraid of or the way they're attacking themselves or something. It's a highly intuitive process. But I think... asking, you know, in fact, I just did a session with a woman that's going to be turned into some sort of a documentary piece or something, and it was a last-minute thing, and the marketing person that I was working with said, if you could find somebody who's got a real problem and they're stuck and you don't know them, you've never seen them before, and they know that something's wrong, but they just can't let go of a grievance. And somebody else said, I know just the perfect person. So this was a lady who's something occurred 15 years ago with her husband, and she won't even say what it is. And obviously she's holding on to major grievances. And it was, she said, do I have to tell you what happened? And I said, no. You just have to tell me how you feel about what happened. So often, if you can get somebody to talk about what the feeling is that's associated with this grievance or this person you hate or what have they done or something, then I find it very easy to help that person see how this is really their own projection, how this is really a statement of their own self-hatred rather than of somebody else, and so on. In other words, you can't really get into a long, because it's specific with each person. But I find that mostly I follow my intuition when I'm talking to somebody about that. But you can really pursue, you know, what is hanging on to this grievance doing for you?
Like, yeah, there's, you know, I work with all that, but the one thing that I hadn't worked with yet was what's the threat?
Yeah.
I think that's brilliant.
And if you ask them, what are you afraid of? What are you going to lose? And then if people are honest, you can get into a wonderful exchange and lead people into, what do I think is going to happen to me if I let go of these grievances? See, primarily, this is what we believe. I hear people say this all the time, that, well, I can't just let myself be out there. You know, I can't let anybody, I can't be with those people anymore that I'm so sure hurt me, because if I'm really out there and being who I am and being open and being undefended, then they'll hurt me even more. You know, so the Course talks about the upside down and backwards thing that we've got going. And the first thing that I would want to point out to anybody is, when we feel like we have to hold back and hold in because that's going to make us safe from whatever's going to get us out there, it's like, oh, you guys, it's the holding back and holding in that's causing your hurt in the first place.
Right, yeah.
It's only by completely reversing that course. So there's so much educating about how life really works, which is why the name of our series. And that's certainly one of them. But if people are willing, and I'm sure they trust you, so that if they will trust you to lead them to, what are you afraid of? What are you going to lose? What's going to happen to you? Because all of that stuff is based on that old, very early survival level programming. And as you can get more down to that, that's the part that we're trying to reprogram in the first place. So anything that takes you to that is wonderful.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thanks, Carol.
You're sure welcome. And thank you for your comment about Bill. I love that.
Yeah, I really felt him come in, and I just went, wow, I think, we'll all have that. You know, anybody that listens to this recording or that's live here today, I think, you know, like Bill, he's probably even more so than just us, but I think there's a real special, special is probably
in the proper use of the word, yes.
In the proper use, yeah, we're all special. But, you know, I just think it's very touching to be part of this. Thanks.
Wonderful.
Can I interject something here? Doug, when, you know, I first brought you on the line, we said hello. Did you notice, and you're saying, you know, you can feel Bill, and I didn't have it in my head as those words, but just in hearing Carol tell about him, and especially about the day he died, I really didn't want to hear the end. Like, I don't want to see him hurt. I wanted to hold him and protect him, and like he already is my friend, and I've never met the man, and I didn't know what he looked like until I got Carol's book. But when I told you to go ahead and ask your question to Carol, did you catch that I accidentally called you Bill?
Yeah, I did.
I had a moment of embarrassment, but then I had the question, why did you do that? There was something to that, and I think it was because I am feeling that presence, because I certainly know your name, Doug.
Yeah. I think when Carol talked about... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just like take it away. And Bill came out, and I can't say it's simply because, I mean, we're talking about a lot of people here. We've got Bill, Jerry, Judy, Jack, you know, all these, this whole cast of characters in the inner circle. And then when I go to say your name, Bill came out. I just thought that was interesting, and I would say that he is here with us. I certainly feel a pressure in my heart that he's smiling and that he is at peace, and that he feels gratitude toward us for taking our own journey to the extent that we have. That's all I wanted to interject. But did you have another question for Carol?
Well, if I can. The second thing, we'll keep it to A Course in Miracles, because I coach and train and all the rest too. But I'm always looking for ways where we take the lesson of the day, or if somebody has a situation and then we're applying what we've read that night in our class, or and just kind of like take it to where the, like, out into daily life and where the rubber hits the road. So I'm always mm-hmm. trying to just bring it right down to its simplest form. And I think I got to get your DVD series, because it sounds like you're headed in that direction. That
much what we're interested in is how to make this practical. What do you do when your 17-year-old kid is on drugs and won't pay any attention to you? You know, it's like, what do you do then? You know, how do I really approach this?
And so I'm always headed in that direction, so that when people walk out of the class, it's not just pie in the sky and we're at Course in Miracles. It's like, you know, when the poop hits the fan,
mm-hmm.
Do I have some of this in my toolbox? And just wondering if there's a few things you could share around that, Carol.
Yeah, in terms of coaching people, or in terms of getting to what's really bothering them?
Or just in terms of, you know, like, how do they take this? We've had a great hour. Like, when we meet, we're together for an hour in our Course in Miracles group.
Uh-huh.
And we usually read a section, and then we have a discussion about it. And sometimes people have things to share in their lives, and I always direct it, or as best I can, back to the reading or the lesson that we're working with that night.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times in that direction, or if I'm explaining or sharing, I try and get it into such simple terms that, you know, like tomorrow when all of a sudden, you know, they're faced with a situation that they go, oh, right, I can choose peace instead of this, or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. Whatever it might be.
You know, some tricks up your sleeve. Like I'm always look for, like, I love humor and I love the easy way and I love simplicity, and so, you know, any more tricks I could put in my toolbox to go, oh, well, just, you know, have a look at it this way, you know.
Well, often you can help people figure out what the issue is if you get as quickly as possible into what they're feeling.
Right.
In other words, because often what the head says and what they're feeling are not the same.
Right.
In other words, they can say they believe one thing and they can intellectually believe it, but the feelings they have about it aren't the same. And in that case, the feelings in your guts will always prevail, you know, over what you think you know in your head. And I used to do a group called Partners in Inner Peace, and we didn't exactly follow, we weren't doing the lessons one at a time, but I would ask people if, you know, if they had, you know, what was your week like, kind of thing. And so somebody would say, well, it was kind of a crummy week because, you know, this person that I work with, blah, blah, blah. And so I would, this was really interesting, something you might want to try too, or maybe you already do something like this. So there used to be, I don't know, 45 or 50 people or something in this particular group, and we were in chairs that we could move around. So I would ask that person to come up and kind of sit on the hot seat with me, and everybody else would kind of put themselves in a circle around here, and I'd say, okay, I just want the 25 words or less version of what the problem is, and then kind of start to lead them, starting with, well, what is the feeling that came up for you when the person sitting at the desk next to you did whatever it is they did, so that very quickly you can move from it's about the other person to start taking responsibility for this is mine, so to speak, which is what all of those lessons are trying to get us to do, you know, is that I must take responsibility for what my experience is. So
yeah.
I wouldn't so much call it exactly like something in my toolbox. I would say the most predominant tool in my toolbox is paying attention to my intuition. In other words, like, what is it that's really troubling this person? And actually, it's pretty transparent. I mean, you don't really have to be terribly tuned in to be able to tell what's really happening with a person, how the guy at the desk next to you is really triggering your own sense of being unworthy.
Right.
You know, and then once that's discovered, then the person sitting next to you at the desk has served their purpose in a sense. They've gotten you in touch with how you really feel. And then you can run with that.
Right.
In other words, in terms of the fact that that feeling has been around since long before you met that person, and that the purpose of the course and the lessons are to undermine those ideas that bring forward those feelings. And I, so far as I don't do so much exactly techniques as much as following my sense at any moment. And I don't know how I would tell anybody other than follow your intuition no matter where it takes you.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when you're dealing with somebody.
Yeah.
But the lessons are there, since they're all designed, and of course, as you know, since you facilitate groups, they're designed in order to dredge stuff up in the most effective way for letting go.
Yeah.
They're masterful at doing that. And I remember somebody called me one day, sort of in answer to your question, and she was all in a big twit about something that happened with one of her kids at dinner. And she said, I don't know what to do. I don't know how this works. I did my lesson, or I do my lessons. And I said, what does doing your lesson mean to you? And she said, well, I read it when I get up in the morning. And I said, but do you apply it during the day? Like, what did you do when you were disturbed by your son at dinner? Did you take that lesson and actually, I don't remember what lesson it was, but did you actually apply that to that situation? And, well, no. You know, it's like, so a lot of people think doing the lessons is I just read them in the night and in the morning, but the thing that I'm sure you stress is they must be applied. When there was a guy here, do you remember when the Challenger blew up back in 1986? In January. Well, there was a fellow who was a course teacher down here in Florida who was an engineer who worked on that flight. So he was up really, really, you know, as close as you can get without being directly underneath it kind of thing. And he was standing there very close when the thing blew up. And at first he was just overcome with kind of shock and horror. And he immediately grabbed hold of the idea as he was watching the pieces falling out of the sky, say, I could see peace instead of this. I could see peace instead of this. You know, I want to be in my right mind where that is my option right now, even when pieces of the Challenger are falling out of the sky. And he said he just settled. He could, because what these lessons do is move you away from your fear and out of the primitive brain that's in the brainstem and back up to the frontal lobe where you can be an adult instead of just being in your fight or flight kind of mentality. But that, it's what it does. It allows you, if you really focus on that lesson, which he did, he said he immediately calmed down, which means he immediately was no longer afraid.
Yeah.
Fear had been replaced with something else. And that, of course, is the point. No matter where I am, where I lose my peace, those lessons, if you actually pay attention to them, can bring you back to it.
Yeah.
Thus undermining so much of our old programming and allowing us to be hardwired in another way.
Yeah.
It's amazing how it works.
Wow. That whole exchange was amazing. Wow. Thank you, Doug.
Thanks so much, Carol.
You're most welcome. I'm excited and happy for every single person on the planet who decides to jump in there and do what they can to help people with this material. So thank you.
And
yeah,
Carol, Doug really has it going on. We had a nice conversation yesterday. He's telling me what he's doing with it, and I'm I was so amazed and impressed at how he applies. You know, we all have our own kind of style for teaching, and just the way he described his project and his new book, I'm going to have him on the air in a couple weeks.
Wonderful.
I think people need to know what he's doing. It is that remarkable. So, Doug, I really appreciate
you
taking the time.
I'll be able to put myself in your seat.
Oh my God!
Fantastic.
That'll be fantastic. Like when you had Bill in the circle.
Oh yeah.
Well, I'll tell you I'm there. I'll just tell you, if I don't listen to it live, I'll listen to it archived, and then you'll never know when I'm going to do it.
Put him on edge.
Right.
I'm never upset for the reason I think. I'm just going to mute your phone, Bill, so I don't...
Okay,
Thanks, Charles. Bye. But I'm going to mute your phone so I don't disconnect you, and I'm going to go to another call. Thank you so much, Doug. Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, I'm going to go to our other caller who's on the line, area code 424. Hi, you're live on the air with Carol Howe. What's your name?
Hi, it's Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn.
How are you?
I'm
doing well, thank you.
Carolyn is my very first Course in Miracles student.
Wow, well, that's impressive.
Yes,
how are you,
Carol? I was listening to you talk earlier about it finding you.
Yeah.
About the book finding you, and that is so true because I'm a success story. Charlotte introduced me to this book, and I was taken up with a lot of bad things in my past, and I can tell you today that I am flourishing and doing so much better that now that I've gotten rid of all that negativity in all the past. And
fabulous.
Helped me through it. And what's even funnier is that one of the persons, I guess one of the egos that was my problem, we have the best relationship now. So
I can't tell you how many people I have talked to over the years who say, basically, when they did their work unilaterally, not with mm-hmm. an agreement of anybody else, they'll say,
no.
It's amazing how everybody around me is different now.
Mm. Right. Oh, that's so true.
And allows
so
us to be friends instead of enemies.
Exactly, because there's lots.
Yeah.
And there's love with everything in my life now because of it.
Isn't
and
that
things
amazing?
Things come to me with love and not with anger or, I don't know, conflict, whatever you might want to say,
mm-hmm.
whatever adjective you want to use there.
Yeah.
But I'm just thankful that it found me.
Well, I feel the same way. I think we're in good company. Ken Wilber, I don't know if you know his name. He's considered by many to be probably our foremost philosopher of our days. And he said there's nothing like it on the planet. You know, it's as good as it gets.
I mean, once you open your mind, you know, that's the best.
And of course, that's part of its purpose, is to help us open our minds that we have slammed shut.
Right.
It finds you. It does.
And when it does, that is your time to handle that.
Absolutely. And you also know you can. And the other thing, of course, that I'm sure that you have noted about the Course is that its teaching of non-duality is not unique. There are other practices, you know, especially in the East, but it's unique in this way. It's focus on healing your mind through healing your relationships. There is no other non-duality teaching that focuses on healing relationships is the fast track to that clear, peaceful, awakened mind.
Right, and I'll tell you, I'm here to say that is really what I needed to do, and thanks to Charlotte too for mentioning it for me and helping me with it, because I was a lost soul. I was living in the past,
and we are lost when we're living in the past, and so it's great to know physics comes to our rescue here, that each moment is a new, clean, discontinuous, that's the important word, discontinuous moment from everything that precedes it. In other words, right now is a clean slate, and the past doesn't intrude unless I drag it along and insist that it intrude.
Right, and I have the tools now to not drag it with me.
Absolutely. That
and
is certainly
forward,
part of the
that's
idea.
That's why I'm able to excel more and to be a better person and to be a happier person.
Absolutely.
Because I wasn't happy, you know, at all because of all this. And I, you know, it was I was had this continual cloud, it felt like, around me.
Well,
so,
exactly. And we do. I mean, fear literally clouds us.
Yes.
You know, that's
yes.
an accurate word.
Very
and,
accurate.
And we're clouded, and our internal subjective experience can feel dark or
sure.
ominous or however it
oh,
feels.
Trust me,
and
I have all those feelings.
And because it's our subjective experience, we think everybody experiences life that way, and that, like, that's how life is, that it's just a big,
yeah.
dangerous place. And all of that gets to be unlearned, and we can find out, well, that's a myth. It's not true. Mercifully,
correct.
It's not true.
Correct. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank
I
you.
I just wanted to tell you thank you so much.
Well, bless
it's
your
awesome.
Heart. Thank
I
you for saying
I wish more people
so.
Would find it for themselves, the world would be a happier place.
It would. And never underestimate the amount of helpfulness that any one person who diligently tries to put this into practice and coming to
yes.
a place of greater peace is doing way more in the whole collective consciousness shifting than we can really fathom.
Right,
but it's good
right.
to know
it's,
that's going on.
I think that concept is like the electricity. Everybody turns off a light, you know,
mm-hmm.
same thing, or turns on the light. Well, you know, maybe that wasn't a very good example, but.
Yeah.
You understand the concept.
I
of
do. It's sort of the rising tide floats
like
all boats idea.
uh-huh. Our carbon footprint.
Yes.
But thank you so much, and I just wanted to share that it really helped my life. So
thank you, my dear.
And,
I'm glad you
and
called.
I have
it was
to,
a wonderful night.
And
thank
I have
you.
To add,
yes.
I have to add, Carolyn, that back then this was 12 years ago at least.
Yes.
That
12
that
years. Yes, it was 12.
Carolyn
years.
And I stumbled upon each other, and she was in such a place. And I had to be very careful in how I handled the situation.
Very careful.
And I didn't want to give her. She had specific questions.
I wanted an answer.
And you wanted answers to very specific questions, and I refused to tell her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her courage that got her through. And doing
yes.
the lesson, whether she wanted to
yep.
or not, she did it anyway. She was courageous. And eventually... I needed her to get to a place. She got all the answers she wanted, but they came up from within her and
mm-hmm.
didn't have to come from someone outside of her. And that's what was so incredible about your journey, Carolyn. And
yes.
I'm so proud of you. It makes
Thank
me cry.
You. I'm proud of you,
You're
too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, you know, you bring up an important point, which is I continually feel quite in awe of the courage that it takes to embark upon this process.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I had known in the beginning exactly what I was getting into. It's kind of like having a baby. You don't really know what you're getting into until it's too late.
That's for sure.
But my hat's off to anybody who says, okay, I have no idea what I'm getting into, but all
that's
right,
exactly
I'll start with
I
lesson
did.
One.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did because I didn't know what else to do anymore. I knew that I wasn't going to live my life like that anymore.
Well,
and
see,
that's
we finally
that
come
faith.
To that. There's got to be a better way. And
yeah.
And with and, each person who decides there's got to be a better way, and I intend to find it, it keeps making it easier for all those to follow.
Right. And
which
and
is wonderful.
Thank goodness. Yes, it's a blessing.
Great. All right. Well, thank
so
you, Carolyn.
So blessed to meet Charlotte. Thanks, Charlotte.
You're welcome,
and
sweetheart.
Thank you, Carol.
Bye.
And I'm going to mute your phone so I don't disconnect you, Carol. I'm just going to mute it, okay? And thanks for calling
okay.
in.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks,
all right,
Charlotte.
Sweetheart.
Bye.
All right, love you. Bye. Isn't she wonderful, Carol?
Absolutely. I'm very in awe of people who are willing to do that hard work in the beginning of taking a look at, oh, my God, look at what's down here in these subterranean places.
Yes, I remember those early days and what came up. And a lot of this, it's important to note that a lot of the memories that do come up are so buried and so obscured by adult life or wherever you are in your life that the things that we tuck away and don't think about anymore, and they get buried in the body, in the cells of the body. And
sure
the
do.
Total cathartic process of allowing it to come up, really being able to look at it, because the book says it shouldn't hurt to look at the past, because once you turn around, there's nothing there that to really frighten you. So
mm-hmm.
we've definitely
been brainwashed about that, as if there's certain that things will overwhelm us if we start to look at them. It's like, no, they won't, because you've got help.
Yes, and
we forget that we're not making this journey by ourselves.
Right. And
that
so
we've got help. Whatever help we need, we've got. If you need
exactly.
a noodle connector, you'll have a noodle connector.
A noodle connector, oh my God. you can borrow my noodles, they're in my trunk. But
anything we need, as long as our intention is to move forward in our opening up, letting go of
right.
grievances, letting go of the excuses to hold back and hold in.
Yes.
And we'll
and
get all the support in the world.
I want to bring something up. We have a little over 9 minutes left. Can you believe it? It's already been almost 2 hours.
Wow.
I know. You and I can go. But what I wanted to point out is a lot of people, when they start the course, they get on this, there's a sense of euphoria that overcomes you. And you do get to a place, although it's a very early and very, I'll say top level, because I think this unlearning happens layer after layer after layer, as does forgiveness
mm-hmm.
and the restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
But what many students, and I want to hear your what you would advise for this. Many students experience that euphoria, and I caution my students, be careful, because the higher you go, the farther you have to fall. And if you start to crash, do not stop coming to class. But I'm sure you've seen this in your students over 32 years of teaching this. What?
Actually, it's been about 35 by this time.
35. So
that's outdated.
I mean, we can't lock and bolt the door and prevent them from leaving. But when they start that crash, I see it coming, and I just want to say, hold on, you know. And I know what I tell people, but what do you advise against people who start to feel the crash? And not let their ego say, this isn't for you, this doesn't work, because it certainly works. But then they start to get afraid, and they go back into the comfortable
mm-hmm.
dark pit. How would you respond to that? What would you advise?
Well, first of all, you can't prevent somebody from saying, this is too much, I'm not going to do it. In other words, if
right.
I remember my greatest concern, this seems so silly when I say it now, was that people were going to find this material offensive, because my early program was don't ever offend anybody. And it was one reason I really dragged my feet teaching this class in the first place. I thought, I'm not going to teach a class, because I had taught a lot of other things before. Teaching is a piece of cake. It's not the teaching part. It's the subject matter. I thought, this is like poking a stick in a hornet's nest. You're definitely
yes.
going to upset people, and they're going to be offended. And so my worst nightmare came true one time during one of these six-week classes. One lay somehow the business about God didn't create the world kind of thing, that this is more an illusion in our own minds. And this lady started to cry right out loud, I mean wail, and got up and ran out the door, and I never saw her again. It's the only time that ever happened, but I was desensitized after that. It was, you know, people will, if they can only come to three classes and then get so scared they have to leave, great.
Mm.
In other words, a seed's been planted. If people hang in there, because what used to happen, I could see the rhythm in a six-week thing. They'd be
yeah.
real excited in the beginning. They would get to the end of the third class and start to recognize what's being called for here and kind
yeah.
of bottom out. And then, like the lessons in the workbook, they tear things down in the beginning and then build them back up, you know,
right.
in the second part. And mm-hmm. then the hopefulness would return in sessions 4, 5, and 6. But I began to see that pattern when people really came face-to-face with what's called for on our part. It's like, oh, no, I was hoping for a magic bullet or
yes.
a magic elixir that I could just do this fast. It's like, well,
oh.
you don't do it fast, but you can do it. You can do it more peacefully than the way we often do it in our lack of understanding, which is why we are so, I mean, I have my whole life work with the course has been about A, making it practical, you know, so that you know what to do with it, so you don't have, well, I've got my life here and I've got my Course in Miracles here and never the twain shall meet kind of thing. So making it clear, making it accessible, making it obvious, and helping people clear out the stuff that keeps it from being obvious, and I'm certainly devoted to that. And
yes.
but you can't make people be any place they aren't. So if they say, oh, I've flipped through this and already know all this, which I actually had somebody say one time as she flipped through all those pages back in the original edition, she said, I've flipped through this and I already know all this. Or
oh,
people will
God.
Say, oh, I've taken that Course in Miracles. Like, well, I don't know what they mean, but you know that they don't understand what it's for, that this is a
Absolutely.
Lifelong pursuit, but
yeah.
that doesn't mean it's all onerous. It's a little shocking at the beginning to realize how self-centered we are and how much we've made the world be all about us, and the idea mm-hmm. of reversing that seems daunting in the beginning, but it doesn't have to stay daunting. In other words,
right.
And our goal is to shorten the daunting part so that you can see the reward, you can move quickly through the things we need to move quickly through. That's
right.
our purpose. That's our purpose.
Wow. Well, there's we're down to just a few minutes here, Carol, believe it or not. And I did want to ask more about the See How Life Works series, but I guess we're at a point where why don't we just tell everybody, I know they're going to want to see this, from what Carol told me about this series, you have a subject that you're using, a woman?
Well, that's just this. That's a different thing. In other words,
we're making
a documentary about a woman who is devoting herself to studying the course and watching our DVDs. She puts them on at night and turns them
okay.
down, you know, to a low volume and listens to them all night long, you know, to literally reprogram herself with
okay.
what's in there. And so she's done an amazing job. So we're doing we're filming her progress and going to do a documentary about that. But then the other lady is another documentary and so on
okay.
and so forth. But we would surely invite you, if people are looking at your website, we would invite them. You'll see three websites, my Carol Howe website, which is just my personal site, the Never Forget to Laugh site, which is the one about the book, and then See How Life Works. And we would encourage people to go to your site, your Blog Talk Radio site, which
my show page she's talking about,
are on right now. Yes, your show page. And
yes.
the third one down is the See How Life Works one. We would encourage people to use that link right there mm-hmm. and go to that website and find out more about it. There are clips from the videos that are already available. There's a lot of stuff to read, a lot of stuff to look at, a lot of stuff to find out about.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to every project that you're working on. Of course, if you need a volunteer, I'm up for the job. Anything you
Great.
Need that I can help you with, yeah, you will do anything I have time for.
Wonderful.
I cannot thank you enough for coming on the air and sharing with us your heart and your love for Phil and, you know, your memories and making us part of them, in a sense.
Well,
really
thank you for letting me come. I love to let people know that the course has an amazing history, if you just only knew what it was, in addition to the fact that it is just the greatest gift on the planet.
Okay. Well, I do hope
as
you'll come back
concerned.
When you have time. If there's anything else you'd like to talk about, we'd love to all sit and listen to you, okay?
Wonderful. All right. Well,
okay.
thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. I feel like, you know, there's course family out there, either current or perhaps to come, and hello to everybody.
Hello. Okay, everybody. Thank you so much, Carol, and
thank you, everyone,
for tuning in. Okay, Carol.
Night.
So good night, everybody. God bless.
Good night.
For listening. And good night from Carol. And be at peace, everyone.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye, Carol.